We're good to go. Shabbat Shalom. We are on part two. Actually, I intended this to be all one last week's and this part together into one message, but it was too much to try to do. And actually, after last week's discussion time, it was kind of confirmed that it would have been better had it all been together, because then a lot of the discussions and the questions that came up wouldn't have happened, because we'd have had the whole explanation. But be that as it may, here we are, and we're going to finish kind of this treatment of the Genesis account. We're going to finish that today, and the reason I wanted to do that first and have this treatment of that was really in preparation for what is coming, to establish the importance of light in the creation as we go into next week. So very quickly, let's recall last week and kind of get our bearings so that we can continue forward. Okay, this was our biblical basis for looking into the science of creation, because it reveals God's handiwork. Hopefully in the process of doing this, God is exalted, and that's what we want to have accomplished, that He is exalted, that we are humbled by His eternal power and Godhead. So, recalling our synopsis from last week, we know that God's creation reveals His invisible attributes. That's the basis, getting to know Jehovah. We know that the Bible and archaeology agree that man has been on this planet longer than 6,000 years, you know. And regardless of the inaccuracy of some dating methods, we know that science can date the Earth and objects in the universe much older than that of just this 6,000 time period. The point being that, yeah, you can argue about carbon dating and all of that and different things, but the bottom line is it's at least more than 6,000. So we saw in Psalm 90 that God's perception of time from His vantage point is different than ours. We also saw that there are generations inside the days of creation. They knew this, and that they stated, while the 6 days of creation are literally 24-hour periods, all of the ages of the universe are contained therein. And we then have the revelation that both statements, that God made the universe in 6 days, and that the universe is billions of years old, are both true. In Genesis, God is speaking from His perspective. He literally created the universe in 6 days. And we've called that universe days or cosmic days. But those same 6 days actually equate to billions of years of earth days from our perspective in the universe. It's relative. That's why we talked about relativity. All the ages of the universe are in those 6 days. Number five, the Hebrew reflects the perspective change. So the Bible, we talked a lot about how the Bible supports this, that there is a complete change in the way the Bible is being told in the Genesis account versus the whole rest of the Bible after Adam. There is no possible way that the first 6 days are being described on earth time, because for the first 2 days there wasn't an earth. So therefore, the only available perspective is that the 6 day account is based on universe time, because earth time wasn't even established yet. So our goal is to figure out what that universe time is. What is it? And finally, we have that illustration to show how the stretching of the universe affects light and reaches how it reaches us and the relativity of time. Okay, now in explaining that, we did talk briefly about Einstein and his work on relativity. And in the subsequent years since him, all of that has been studied, measured, and it is considered fact now. And I introduced that concept in this message so that you could begin to grasp the effects of time. That it's not this constant that we believe it to be. The only reason we believe it to be a constant is because we only experience it from here. And so to us, it is a constant, but it's not the same everywhere. And in order to further explain it, I presented this illustration. And this was designed to show how an expanding universe would cause one that had the perspective from the beginning to be different from the one that's looking backwards at it. And the point was that both are correct. As the illustrative pulses of light move across that distance, the distance was expanding. Therefore, the space in between the pulses of light got bigger. And so if you measure time by the distance between the pulses, the one at the beginning stated they were 1 second apart, and he's correct. The one receiving them says, no, they're billions of years apart, and he's correct. That was the only point of that illustration. And if you'll recall, before I submitted this, I said, and I went back and looked. So I'm going to quote myself. I said, quote, understand that the illustration I'm about to show you is just that, an illustration. It's to help us get our minds around the concept. It is not the science. Close quote. And then I gave the illustration. And so I gave that, and so that the message wouldn't be too long, I stopped there and didn't continue with all of the science and everything that that we're going to look at today. But what happened in the discussion is that I got, we got to talking about defending the illustration scientifically, and there's all sorts of legitimate questions around that, isn't there? Gravitational forces are different throughout the universe. Is the speed of light a constant all the time? Could it have been different before? Not knowing what those forces were in the very beginning. We weren't there. What was the gravitational force like that? On and on. But I will maintain that this illustration is a good one for the purpose in which it was designed, that it's helpful in understanding the concept. And I agree, it does nothing whatsoever to explain how it actually happened or works. Okay. It brings about a multiple of questions, and doesn't really answer any of them. And one of the big ones, really, is the effect of gravity. We talked about that in relationship to time dilation. And I want to share a few quotes from Mr. Schroeder's book in addressing this. He says that changes in gravity and changes in the velocity at which we travel actually change the rate at which our time flows. Huge changes in gravity or velocity are required to produce easily measurable changes in the flow of time. The law of relativity tells us that the flow of time at a location with high gravity or high velocity is actually slower than in another location with lower gravity or lower velocity. This means that the duration between ticks of a clock, or the beats of a heart, or time to ripen oranges in the high G or high V environment is actually longer than the duration between the ticks of a clock in the low G or high V environment. These differences in time's passage are known as time dilation. I decided to put this up here because It addresses the effects of various gravitational forces on time. You need to understand that Mr. Schroeder understands that. So when applying that to our illustration, the illustration breaks down, doesn't it? Because it doesn't provide for that. In other words, as the light moved through the universe, it was affected by various different gravitational forces. Those forces changing as the universe expands. So it's not as simple as this little stick figure drawing makes it out to be. In fact, when you consider that velocity and gravity affect time and how things age, and that velocity and gravity across the universe is all different, that would mean that the age of the universe is different depending on where you are in it. Catch that? If we were somewhere else and we were saying, okay, what's the age of the universe? If we're talking about gravitational forces and velocity, then the age would be different over there and different over here and different over there. It's this fact that caused much discussion last week to our little illustration here. This illustration works great at providing a way of wrapping our minds around the effects of an expanding universe as light passes through it. It also helps us realize that based on perspective, both statements that the Earth was created in 6 days and that the Earth is billions of years old can be equally true. But it doesn't explain how we know that. To be fair, there are many... What? I don't know. To be fair, there are many theories and explanations about the things we're discussing here. There are even questions about whether the speed of light is a constant. But there is a way of measuring all of this that does not take... that doesn't need to take these things into account. There is a measurement of time across the universe that is equal everywhere. It's called cosmic time, and that's what science calls it. And so what I'm about to share with you is interesting, not just because of the science, but understand that it's because it's how well it matches with the biblical record. That's what makes it cool. Mr. Schroeder took known scientific values and used math to see where they led. And once those calculations were done, then he compared them to the Genesis account to see if they matched. It is the fact that they match is what makes this intriguing. He didn't look at the Genesis account and then go to science and see how he could prove it. Okay, there wasn't a theory there. What he did was he said, these are the known facts. How do they calculate out? And then, does it match? Okay. In other words, the science stands on its own. It's the fact that his application of the scientific research agrees with the Bible that makes it compelling. So what did he do? Well, he realized a significant error in exploring time, one that we touched on last week. That is, and we just discussed, and that is that the various gravitational forces and velocities around the universe would make time different relative to where you are in that universe. And so realizing that, he began to look for a reference frame that would encompass all of the universe regardless of location. And he wrote this: the clock of Genesis starts with the creation of the universe and continues till the creation of humankind. That's the Genesis account. It must identify the relative passage of time, not between particular places in the universe, but between moments in the universe as the universe evolved from the Big Bang. So the question becomes, then, how to measure those moments? he realized that there was a peer-reviewed, accepted method to do so, and then he wondered how that measurement of cosmic time would line up with the Genesis account. To get there, we're going to talk about two things that give us two of the values that Mr. Schroeder used in his calculations: CMBR and quark confinement. CMBR stands for cosmic microwave background radiation. When the universe was first spoken by God, what scientists call the Big Bang, there was tremendous heat. Tremendous heat that was essentially a gigantic stellar nuclear reaction. And CMBR is the remnant of that radioactive heat. It was discovered back in 1965, and we've been monitoring it ever since. And it is cooling. It is cooling very slowly, but it is cooling at a consistent rate. Now, scientists have been testing this, and they have come to the conclusion, given the properties of space, there's a lot of space in space, that cooling rate, they believe, has to have been constant. In other words, consistent throughout time. Of course, we can't test that because we weren't there. But if we believe that to be true, and then we use that in, as a constant in various calculations, and then those calculations line up with the red shift of light. And remember, the red shift is what tells us whether, remember I covered that, and if the waves, and if you're going towards something, they compress. If you're going away, they stretch. And with light, it's red shift or blue shift in the colors of the light. And so by measuring that, we can tell how far away we are from something. Well, if in 1965 the CMBR temperature is certain deal, and the red shift tells us we're X from a planet, and then, or a sun, and then, you know, 20 years later, red shift tells us we've moved this much, and it corresponds to the same amount of cooling on the CMBR, you have two things, two witnesses, right? Okay, so we have two witnesses. Now, in order to know, though, the age of the universe, we need to not only know the current temperature and the rate of cooling, but we need another value. We need the starting temperature, don't we? Okay, you follow? Because here's my analogy. If you've ever watched a cop show on TV, and the cop comes up and there's a victim laying there and he's dead, and he really needs to know when he died, because if he doesn't know when he died, he won't know whose alibis are good or bad, right? He needs to know when he died. So what's the ME do, the medical examiner? He comes and he measures the liver temperature. And why does he do that? Because he knows the temperature of a living liver. Okay? He knows the rate that liver will cool after the body dies. Okay? And so if he knows that, both of those things, right? Now, think about it. If he also had, let's say, and don't ask me why he would have this, but just roll with me. Let's say he has a thermometer on him, this victim, and the bullet goes through the thermometer and kills him, and so the thermometer gets stuck on the exact temperature it was when he died. Now he knows the starting temperature, he knows the ending temperature, he knows the rate, and he knows exactly when the guy died. All right? That's what we need. Well, the CMBR gives us the current temperature. Monitoring those falling temperatures since 1965 gives us the rate, as is confirmed by the redshift of light. Now, the last piece would be to know what the starting temperature is. That's where quark confinement comes in. That is literally at the Big Bang when all matter and light went out into the universe. It's not the very first thing that happened when God spoke. It's what happened first was this explosion of really, really hot, radiant energy. It's just pure energy. Matter formed from that energy. Okay, that's where this famous statement of E equals mc squared. What's that mean? It means that energy equals the speed of equals mass by the speed of light squared, which is, by the way, a huge number. Speed of light is 186,000 miles per second. You take 186,000 and times it by itself, you get a pretty big number. Okay? And so what he's saying is that's the amount of energy, the amount of energy in just a small piece of matter. If you release the quark within that, it is a gigantic thing. I read a deal once that said one page in a book, if you were actually able to harness the quarks in that page of that book, you could power the city of Los Angeles for 10 years. Massive amounts of power, massive amounts of energy are in, that's what these quarks are, okay? And when God spoke them out into the universe, he spoke them out, and then they expanded to about the size of our solar system. Pretty good size, but infinitesimal in the size of the universe now. That happened in 0.00001 seconds. Boom, he spoke. And scientists call this plasma. Okay, it was kind of a mixture of light and dark. It's just, you know, when we speak, sound is light. There's this. We're going to get into that next week. There's a connection there between the two. So he spoke these quarks, and they were like light mixed with the darkness in this plasma, and all these quarks. There's no matter in that. They cooled in this 0.0001 seconds when quark confinement happened. In other words, all this energy, all of this, these basic instructions and these quarks, then assembled at this certain temperature and formed every element, every atom that created the universe, and it began to expand. Okay? We know that the basic building blocks of the universe is not matter. It's quarks, and these quarks are just pure energy. Massive amounts of it that interestingly appear as waves, just like sound and light. It's these quarks that made all the matter that we see around us happened that quick. And it is at that exact point that these quarks confined together and created the mass, energy equals mass, light squared. Okay? So that's what happened. And we know the exact temperature in which that occurs from the book. We know the temperature and hence the frequency of radiation energy in the universe at quark confinement. It is not a value extrapolated or estimated from conditions in the distant past or far out in space. It is measured, this is a nuclear physicist, it is measured right here on Earth in the most advanced physics laboratories and corresponds to a temperature approximately, this is an important number, a million times hotter than the current 3 degrees Kelvin black of space. This nuclear physicist was involved in 6 different nuclear explosions and the development of nuclear weapons. They know the temperature at which quarks confined Why? Because they know the temperature at which they unconfine. Right? Boom. Now look how God describes this in Genesis. Genesis 1. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. When this says without form and void, it's those two words in Hebrew. And tohu, I don't know how to pronounce it, means unformed or chaotic. And so saying without form is fairly good. But the other one doesn't just mean void. It actually means filled with the building blocks of matter. Earth here in this verse, the word earth there, is actually referring not just to the earth, but creation itself. And so it would better be rendered, and the universe was in a state of chaos, but filled with the building blocks of matter. Now, when you think about what I just described there, what we see in science matches quite nicely with this, doesn't it? That God spoke, the quarks went out as light waves, sound and light, both going waves. There was light because God spoke. And that swirling hot plasma mix was a mix of light and darkness. It expanded for 0.0001 seconds, and quark confinement happened, and the light was divided from the darkness. And all the matter in the universe was instantly created from the energy in those quarks. E equals mc squared. And I think it's ironic that physicists actually describe the plasma as light and dark swirling together, and that the quark confinement is as light separating from the darkness. See, because we know the radiation temperature of quark confinement, we know the current radiation temperature, and we know that the difference is a million million times, okay, then we can compare that to the cooling rate, and does it match? Yes, it matches. See, the universe today is a million million times. That's hard to wrap your mind around, but it's a million million times the size that it was at quark confinement. A fraction of a second after God spoke the plasma, the quarks or the light, whatever term you want to use, formed. And as the universe expanded, the stretching of the light waves has slowed the cosmic clock, expanded the perceived time between the ticks of that clock by a million million. See, that's why the illustration, see, helps you understand that. You know, I said that, you know, if you did this a second apart, you know, well, how much distance, how much stretching was there? A million million times. So hence, the cosmic clock records the passage of 1 minute while we are here on Earth to a million million minutes of cosmic time. And that is, as I stated last week at the outset, peer-reviewed physics. The validity of this approach, measuring cosmic time by the current background radiation as compared to the temperature at quark confinement, along with the expansion of the universe, and comparing that to the relative local time on Earth, has been given the stamp of approval by the most prestigious physicists and physicist journals in the world. Now, why would they do that? Because the data points that I just discussed are measured. They're not extrapolated. They're not hypothesized. They're measured and reproduced. They're recorded. The CMBR temperature is recorded. The cooling rate is recorded. The temperature that we know when quark confinement happens is reproducible. Now, could it be wrong? Well, of course, it could be wrong. After all, science for a long time thought the Earth was flat. Some people still do. Okay. But what if you take this, and this is why I'm sharing this. What if you take this and then apply it to the biblical record and it matches? I think that would be pretty fascinating, pretty compelling, and somewhat faith-building. So let's now try and put this all together. And I want to encourage you, if I've lost you along the way with the science and the EMC squared and all this stuff, don't worry about it. Just know that the points, the reason I cover that is to understand that the points that this is based on are valid, okay? If you didn't fully catch it, it's okay. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and divided the light from the darkness. I think that's pretty cool. Let there be light. Plasma. Quarks. There was light. 0.0001 seconds later, he saw the light that it was good, and it divided the light from the darkness. And there you have it. Okay. Okay. Let's see if we can get this slide to go to the next one, maybe. Okay, there we go. By comparing the temperature of the background, I'm just going to try to condense this. By comparing the temperature of the background radiation now to the temperature of the radiation at quark confinement, we can calculate the age of the universe to be approximately 14.75 billion years old. And Mr. Schroeder went through some other things. There's other ways that people have tried to define the age of the universe, and they all fall between 10 to 20 billion years. This one is much more precise. 14.75 billion, and there you go, it falls right in the range. Okay, now that we have that, we have the age of the universe. There's one more quick concept that we need to grasp. We talked about it before, and this is where the illustration again will help from last week, and that is universe expansion. Now stay with me. I was going to try and put this part into my words, but Mr. Schroeder does it very succinctly, so I'm going to. This is from his book. As the universe expanded its size, the scale of the universe, and temperature, and therefore its clock, were becoming ever more similar to that of our current universe. That makes sense, right? I mean, the more it expands, we've expanded to a certain point, the more it expands, the closer it gets to what we are experiencing right now. Because of this, the duration of each successive 24-hour Genesis day encompassed a span of time ever more similar to time as reckoned from our Earth-based perspective. Each doubling in size slowed that cosmic clock by a factor of 2. Since the time required to the universe to double in size increased superlinearly as the size increased, the bigger it gets, its size increased, then you have this fractional rate of change in the cosmic clock relative to our Earth time, and it decreased superlinearly. Basically, what he is saying is that the more the universe expands, the closer the cosmic time lines up to our Earth time, because the universe gets closer to the size that it is now. Okay? The size that it is now relates to how we experience time. So the closer it gets to our universe size, the closer cosmic time matches our time. And the universe expanded at a factor of 2. This expansion factor is consistent with a fascinating mathematical principle we see all around us in creation. We discussed this several months ago. the Fibonacci logarithmic spiral, known as the golden ratio, is prevalent in nature all around us. Remember that video? What was it called? I don't remember what it was called. You remember a video we watched where the more you went in, the pattern.
Fear of God or something.
Yeah, like that. Something like that. But it was based on this, you know. Yeah, that's it. So we see in this that all through nature, from unicellular organisms to flowers and even enormous galaxies, this golden ratio describes the exponential rate of decay, even of radioactive atoms, which, by the way, is another way of measuring the age of the universe, which also lands right around that 14.75 billion years. You know, God is a master mathematician. This universe, I'm telling you, it's math. The point is to this, and I'm not going to belabor this, but the universe is expanding according to this same golden ratio. So, where are we at now? Now we know that the universe is 14.75 billion years old. And that the correlation of cosmic time to Earth time converged by a Fibonacci factor of 2. So given all of that, we're finally able to look at the correlation of cosmic time and Earth time during the 6 days of creation. And it would look like this. This is picture right out of the book. What are you looking at here? Well, if there's 14.75 billion years total in that 6 days, and the universe is expanding, and it's doubling. Every time it doubles, the time, so you notice that day one, which is 24 hours Earth time, is 8 billion years, basically half of the 14.75 billion years, okay? Day two, that goes down by half, so 4 billion years. This 10 to the 12th power here is corresponding to that million times expansion rate. It also corresponds to the redshift of light. Okay, so that's how these calculations. I'm not even going to attempt to go through Schroeder's math. There's actually a formula for this, but it's beyond my pay grade. But so you can see, day one, 8 billion years. Day two, 4 billion, 2 billion, 1 billion, 0.5 billion, 0.25 billion. On day six. And so we end up with a total of 6 days Earth time and 15.75 billion years of cosmic time. What you see here then is a result of calculations in based on those measurements. Radiation temperature of quark confinement compared to the current background radiation. And he's taken into account then the expansion rate, which then gives us the ability of being able to divide up the time in each day. Now, if these values are correct, they would be confirmed by what we get as revelation from God in Genesis. Because now we have a calculated age of the universe and a period of time for each day. And so then we can compare the sequence of scientific observations in paleontology, in physics, in geology, with the events of each day as described in Genesis. And how they line up is extraordinary. We see that day one lasted half of the 14.75 years. Okay.
15.75. All your graphs have said
15, sorry. And now, just like the spiral, we see each day be half of the time remaining. God spoke what science calls the plasma on day one, right? And we read that. He spoke that. The sound waves are essentially light. Those waves we call quarks and expanded, as I said. They cooled to the temperature of quark confinement, and light was separated from darkness. That's what the Bible says. All matter was created at that instance. And what I want you to understand is within the sound structure of those quarks, all the information that was necessary to create the universe was embedded there. At the very, that is so cool. Because see, when that quark confinement happened, every quark had an instruction in it. It knew how to bond those atoms, how to create those atoms and bond them to create every single element in the universe. You know, back months ago when we went through a bunch of the fine-tuning of the universe, all of those instructions, people, were there at that moment. All the different elements formed precisely as encoded. Gravitational constants were established. All that fine-tuning was established in what God spoke out into what they call plasma in these quarks right then. And then this universe just went completely obeying the voice of God. It's amazing. And so for 8 billion years, cosmic time, you know, in our, it's a day to God. He spoke it and watched it for 8 billion years. I see it as the DNA of the universe. You know how much, we talked about that, how much information there is in our DNA? You know how much information there had to be in those quarks, in what he spoke into what they call the plasma? It is mind-boggling. Because you're going to see as we go through this, that in the Hebrew, this is not in my notes, and I might go long here, I don't know, whatever. But in the Hebrew, when God said that he created in Genesis 1:1, there wasn't an indication of creation again until day 5 when he made the animals. What God spoke on day 1, it flowed all the way to day 5. Just the universe just obeying what he had already said. He didn't need to intervene again until day 5. It's amazing. Okay. So then we get to day 2. Day 2 we read this. God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." I wish I had time to go through. He's a Hebrew scholar, and when he talks about what the waters are is amazing. But anyway, he said, "Thus God made the firmament." Now, the firmament is the heavens, okay? Which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. The evening and the morning were the second day. Evening and morning, chaos. Evening, morning. Those words, chaos and order, okay? Right? So, time doesn't permit to go deep into the Hebrew, but Schroeder says this heavenly firmament is the formation of our Milky Way galaxy. That during this time, it's taking this 8 billion years, galaxies and everything are forming. Well, by the, when we get to day 2, somewhere between 750 million years and whatever it is, or not 750, 7.5 billion, and whatever it says on there. we get to the formation of our Milky Way galaxy. And we understand that when we talk about our heavens, what we look up and we see in the sky, that's what we see, is our Milky Way galaxy. That's the stars that we see. Now, with other equipment, we can see deeper. But when you go out in the night sky and you look at the heavens, that's what you're looking at, is our Milky Way galaxy. And he believes that this is what formed then on day two. Day three, we see the cooling of our Earth to the point that we see large bodies of waters. And this is interesting, because geophysical evidence shows that the first appearance of water on this planet was 3.8 billion years ago. And what's it say? It's right there. Interestingly, fossil data has now shown that the first simple plant life appeared immediately after the water appeared, not billions of years later. Why is that? Because the instructions in those quarks, in those atoms for that water, when they get here, boom, planets or plants. The universe went out and obeyed the instructions that was given to it. And those plants happened immediately when the water appeared. Notice how it lines up with Genesis. God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the land earth, and the gathering together of the water he called seas, and God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, that herb yields seed, and that the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, and whose seed is in itself on the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, and the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God said that it was good. And chaos went to order the third day. There is an extended discussion in this book of relating to the Hebrew and the ancient sages, and discusses how the plant life began congruent with the appearance of the water. And here again we see the coding in the quarks just going out and creating everything as the universe develops. You know something, and this is another bunny trail, but it just came to my head and I can't help but share it with you. I think we talked about it last week, but some were out of the room. These quarks communicate with each other. Without any, they don't have to be near each other. Boundaries, walls, whatever, don't matter. They have a way, there is instructions in them. It's the voice of God, people, that hold everything together. When that Bible says that by His power and my, He holds the universe together, He's not kidding. It's not some just fluffy thing. It's the reality of what is around us. Okay, so, huh?
Amen.
Amen, yeah. What's important to notice here is that scientific geophysical evidence puts the arrival of water and plant life specifically at the same time as day three. Day four, we get the sun, moon, and the stars. We read this. God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens, and divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and days and years. Let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens, to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light on the earth and to rule over the day and the night, to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, and there was chaos and order. Now, we just saw that the plants started the day that the water came. We're seeing the next day that the sun is being created. How could that be? That's a puzzle, right? Because wait a minute, you can't have plants without sun. There's no photosynthesis for the plants. What's going on here? Well, it comes from understanding Hebrew. Hebrew reveals, without going into a big explanation, we know that the firmament, the heavens, were created on day two. They're already there. What he's talking about right here, what occurred on this day, is not that they were created. It's really bad translation. It's just that they became visible. They were able to be seen on earth at that time. And what is interesting is science has surmised, has kind of done models of how the earth would have how the earth and its atmosphere would have developed over these billions of years. And they've surmised that in the beginning, at one point, there was a heavy, heavy, like water around the earth, okay? You would not have been able to see the sun, the moon, and the stars. They would have been obscured by that. And so what happened scientifically, corresponding to this day, as calculated here, is that part of the atmosphere dissipated enough that you could actually see with your eyes the sun. The plants were still getting the rays, the ultraviolet rays and whatever they need for photosynthesis through that, but they were not visible to us. And during this time, then, the plants are doing what? They're creating oxygen. The whole dry land was just covered, you know, with all of these plants, and they were creating oxygen. And again, I'm limited on time, but this all lines up with all of these models and how the earth, when the water came, when the plants came, when the atmosphere, you know, dissipated, when oxygen began to be prevalent enough, contained within the atmosphere, that mammals could then survive outside of the oceans. It's just cool. We get to day five. Brings a couple of very interesting events. God said for day five, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves with which the waters abounded, according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. God saw that it was good, and he blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth. And there was chaos and order the fifth day. So as we go back to our chart, we see that we are right in the middle. On day five, you know, 750,000 years ago to 250 million years ago, that is right in the middle of the Cambrian period. That is what science calls the Cambrian period. The Cambrian explosion, yes. The fossil record reveals this sudden explosive appearance of all of the animal life on Earth. They say 530 million years ago. Well, there you go. Right in between on day five, between the 750 and the 250, 530 million years ago, all basic body plans appear. 360 million years ago, still inside day five, we see the rapid succession of amphibian reptiles. The Cambrian explosion, right on cue. Day six begins 250 million years ago and ends a little less than 6,000 years ago. We read this. God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind. cattle and creeping thing and beasts of the earth, each according to its kind, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. God said, let us make man in our own image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. At the beginning of day six, God creates all of the land animals. And that lines up with the early fossil records. And that includes, folks, the dinosaurs. Because, see, science tells us that there was a massive extinction that occurred after that. And then we have that time afterwards that the animals repopulated the earth. And so we have then an interpretative gap between Genesis 1:25 and 1:26. 24 and 25, the land animals were created. Those animals roamed the earth. They populated the earth. You know, we know that. We have the fossil record for that. But then there was a massive extinction, and then time for them to repopulate. Then we have in verse 26, he said, then God said. So there's this then God said in verse 24, and then there's a period of time, and he said, then God said, let us make man. So it's a simplified explanation. There's more detail in the book. But the point is that man was made later in day five from the animals. See, there's no account of the time difference in here, which, by the way, is very consistent with the whole Genesis cosmic time account anyway. Remember, that's one of the things we said, that the Bible, after Adam, begins to be very distinct and using man time to describe events, earth time to describe events. Before that, we don't see that. And it's illustrative here. We just see blocks of time, and this is what happened. We don't see incremental. So knowing that day six occurred between 250 million years ago and a little less than 6 million years ago, and we see inside that time land animals, we see extinction, you know, massive death of animals at a certain point. That's covered in the book when we see that fossil record of a lot of animals dying, and then again them being repopulated, then man coming. All of that occurs in that 250 million years to 6,000 year timeline. Right? So there it is. Land animals, mammals, humankind, massive extinction, all of that. All occurs in that timeline. So there you have it. That's it. That's the convergence of scientific discovery with biblical revelation. And again, the book goes into more detail. I'm simply trying to give a decent overview, and I have a motivation for that. Because I want it to be enough of an overview of the science to make a very, very real statement that I've made a few times before, and I've already made it again today, that everything you see around you, in its essence, is the light of God. That's why that verse says they have no excuse. You want to see God? He's right here. He's right here. He's everywhere. You're standing on it. You're breathing it. Every molecule, every atom, everything in this universe was created by His voice. Literally. And the power in those quarks is what holds it all together. And it is His energy, His power. And it is not a platitude. It is a scientific fact. As we consider our Romans 1 foundation to this series, I'm telling you, nothing could be more scientifically true. light as we know it is invisible to us. You don't see light. I've talked about that before. Go outside and shine a flashlight up there. You won't see the light. The light has to bounce off of something, and that's what you see. You see the image. You don't see the light. It's invisible. It's His invisible attribute. And those invisible attributes are clearly seen. His light is right here. Clearly seen. You only see the light as it reflects off of something, and that's something I want you to meditate about as we go into next week. But for today, just realize it's invisible, and so is sound. They're kind of synonymous. You don't see it, you don't see the light. Yet they are the very components that the entire universe is made of. Science is just now discovering that link between light and sound. We're going to talk about that. Sound actually turns to light as you speak it. You just can't see it. See, God spoke, and those waves of light and sound proceeded from His eternal being. And within that pronunciation was all the power contained in those quarks necessary to make every atom, every element, every single piece of matter in the whole universe. And it all obeyed His voice and formed exactly as He said it should, providing all the fine-tuning, everything that guided the whole entire universe to form, including our earth and everything in it, and our ability to interact with it. You know, and science is just giddy about that, what I just said. They are giddy. Because they look at that and say, see, we don't need a creator. Everything was there in that plasma. Everything was there. And it just flowed from that. It's all natural.
Where'd the plasma come from?
Thank you. Where'd the plasma come from? Where'd the instructions come from? Where's the intelligence? Yeah, DNA makes us who we are. See, it's all there. Where'd the DNA come from? Who coded it? Same thing. God spoke the universe and everything in it from the stores of His own power and intellect. Okay? And it went forth in 6 cosmic days of time, and it took 15.75 billion years of earth time, and both are true. See, we don't have this creationist versus scientist mentality. We don't need to have that. Yehovah, our great God, is the ultimate mathematician and scientist. I want to read a couple of paragraphs from this book to kind of close this up. Mr. Schroeder, in this part, is kind of addressing God's sovereignty. He's talking about, he begins this chapter with an interesting thing. He says, I read this to you this morning, the God an atheist does not believe in is usually not the God of the Bible. Did you catch that? The God an atheist does not believe in is not the God of the Bible. And he says, unfortunately, the God of the believer is also often not the God of the Bible. He's trying to describe his perspective on the fact that God put the universe in motion through that plasma and everything we've talked about, and that science sees it as naturalism, and we see it as, well, that's God's deal. They see it as a possibility that there can be a world without God, because God made the universe to run. And they perceive it as saying, well, the universe can run without God. Right? But we see it running because God designed it that way. Anyway, let me read what he's wrote here. In juxtaposition to skeptics' demands that an infinite biblical God would exhibit infinite and perfect control are the demands of the believer insisting that each species, from microscopic copepods to mammoth elephants, be a separate creation. An infinite God obviously could produce this variety of creatures, but this would not be the God described in the Bible. Throughout the text, we read descriptions of nature functioning naturally. why the creationist paradigm insists on selling short the phenomenal laws of nature is beyond me. Atheists look in awe and wonder at the incredible precision by which the universe functioned to produce an earth brimming with life. The fossil record, exhibiting the immediate appearance of life on the just-cooled Earth 3.8 billion years ago, the amazing explosion of life 3 billion years later, the several massive extinctions that redirected life's flow, most significantly 250 million and 65 million years ago, might superficially be seen as random events. Scrutiny of the complex and interrelated processes involved in those days of old make this position barely tenable. The fossil and cosmological records may not be compatible with the view of God in Newton's day, but they are eminently compatible with the God of the Bible, a God clearly described as having created a universe, and by that creation, having instilled a leeway therein for chance in nature and choice by man. Of all the ancient accounts of creation, only that of Genesis has warranted a second reading by the scientific community. It alone records a sequence of events that mirrors the scientific account of our cosmic origins. His main point is that, you know, when you see time and chance and different things happening and the world working the way that it does, it's because he said it that way so that we would interact with it, right? That it's not, you know, he didn't have to, you know, do every little thing because he set laws in place. His power, guys, to plan and to create is beyond our wildest imagination. Can you imagine coding all this in an instruction set that you could just all that elements, all the fine-tuning, everything? He made all this in six of his days. And this is a being that has lived forever. What's he been up to? What's he gonna do next? When he can speak all this in 6 days. And he's lived forever and will live forever. I don't know about you, but I don't want to miss it. And I want to see what else he's done. Because just this little glimmer is pretty darn cool. And the more you think about that and let that absorb and just overcome, I mean, you just can't help but drop to your knees. Because indeed, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen and understood by the things that are made. Even his eternal power and Godhead, so that all are without excuse. Thus far in this series, we've focused on the physical implications of light and creating the physical universe we live in. But next week, we're going to continue to look at light from a spiritual standpoint that is kind of an eternal perspective. And I believe it leads to one very simple, one hugely impactful revelation that literally can change your perspective and your life forever once you grasp it. Until then, amen.
Amen.
Amen.